Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At 33 years old, Tony Cornell was by no means the most senior member of the Cambridge University Society for Psychical Research, but he was certainly one of the more proactive and always on the lookout for a new site to investigate. Like most members of CUSPR, he was a proud rationalist with little time for superstition or spiritual nonsense, whose interest in supposed paranormal and supernatural events began from a thoroughly skeptical point of view. He did, however, maintain a healthy fascination with the strange due to a peculiar event he experienced 10 years previously. As a young naval officer during the Second World War, Tony was stationed in southern India, close to the Nilgiri Mountains, where he became enthralled by stories of the local fakir, holy men and women without any possessions or relations who were believed to possess mystical powers. It was said that a fakir could perform miracles, with many people travelling for miles to seek their wisdom and guidance. Although thoroughly dubious, Tony was nonetheless intrigued enough to try and find the man, with the hope of witnessing these so-called miracles for himself. Tony trekked for hours through rolling, tree-capped hills and across treacherous paths flanked by steep, jagged cliffs. At about 6,000 feet above sea level, he came across an old man in simple clothes standing at the end of a small plateau, as if he'd been waiting for Tony to arrive. To the side of the plateau lay a steep drop into a gully with a stream gushing through it. Without acknowledging the young Navy officer, the fakir asked what it was that Tony wanted. I hear you can perform miracles, replied a startled Tony. You're too materialistic, said the old man, but I'll give you what you want. There was a pause as the fakir thought for a moment. Tony smiled awkwardly, suddenly self-conscious at the clash of cultures. Look towards those hills, my son, the fakir said finally. Those hills, said Tony, pointing towards some prominent peaks in the east. The fakir gestured yes with a gentle nod of the head, and Tony turned back to inspect them. Do you see? Asked the fakir. A look of confusion came over Tony's face. He scratched his head and turned back to the man. I'm sorry, I don't... But the man wasn't there.
Well, my son, shouted the fakir from the far side of the stream. Did that entertain you?
Tony stood for a moment, trying to fathom how a 70-year-old man
could have dropped into the gully and raced to the other side of the fast-flowing waters in only a matter of seconds. Smiling to himself, he watched as the fakir slowly picked his way along the rocky bank before disappearing into the bush. You're listening to Unexplained, and I'm Richard McLean Smith. The Society of Psychical Research, of which Tony's CUSPR group was an affiliate, was established in 1882, largely in response to a peculiar craze that was gripping the nation. It had its origins in a small wooden house in the tiny hamlet of Hydesville, New York. It was there that in 1848, two sisters, Kate and Margaret Fox, claimed to have made contact with the spirit of a dead man who communicated with them through a series of knocks and bangs. In other words, they'd allegedly made contact with a poltergeist, and in doing so, had inadvertently created a movement that would come to be known as spiritualism. As news of the Fox sisters' incredible claims spread through the UK, it wasn't long before everybody, from scullery staff to Queen Victoria, were conducting seances in an attempt to communicate with the dead. As the movement grew in popularity throughout the world, so too did the stories of strange paranormal happenings that seemed suddenly to be breaking out everywhere. For those caught up in the scientific fervour of the Enlightenment age, the emergence of such stories was a horrifying riposte to the increasingly rationalist and atheistic principles catalyzing academia at the time. Although many in the scientific community dismissed paranormal claims out of hand, a small number of academics, led by Henry and Eleanor Sedgwick, William Barrett and Edmund Gurney, among others, took a different tack. They decided instead to, quote, approach the varied problems without prejudice or prepossession of any kind, in the same spirit of exact and unimpassioned inquiry which has enabled science to solve so many problems, once not less obscure, nor less hotly debated. And so the SPR was born, the world's first Ghostbusters. The Cambridge branch of the Society was founded in 1906. It existed mostly as an organisation for like-minded people to get together and share stories regarding the latest papers and theories they'd read. But sometimes, if they were lucky, the chance for something more hands-on would crop up, like that which Tony Cornell brought to the group one evening in November 1957. The curious case had presented itself a few days earlier, when a young journalist based out of Wisbeach, some 40 miles north of Cambridge, had contacted him. At the beginning of October, Anthony Wilmot, who worked for the Wisbeach Advertiser, had overheard a conversation about some mysterious goings-on at an old manor house known as Hannath Hall, situated out in the floodlands, or fens, close to where he lived. The house, he would later discover, had been plagued by apparent hauntings for years. Wilmot didn't care much for silly ghost stories, but after learning one of the current tenants was local Labour politician Derek Page, he couldn't resist following up on the story. Anthony Wilmot arranged to interview Derek Page and his wife Audrey, as well as Audrey's mother Rose, at the house. He arrived with his tongue firmly in cheek, only to find the family in a genuine state of distress. For the next hour, he was treated to a variety of extraordinary tales, outlining all the strange events they'd experienced at the house since arriving from Cheshire 2 months previously. In fact, They'd only been there a matter of days, Audrey explained, when she was awoken in the early hours of the morning by the sound of a very clear and insistent tapping that seemed to be coming from just outside her bedroom. Thinking she'd imagined it, she turned to go back to sleep, only for it to start up again, this time a little louder. She sat up immediately. Knowing it couldn't have been Derek, since he stayed in another town during the week for work, she assumed it was one of the children, or perhaps her mother, who slept in the bedroom opposite. "Yes?" Audrey whispered out in the dark. "Hello?" "Knock, knock," came the reply. Audrey hurriedly switched on the bedside light. "Hello?" she asked again, but still there was no reply. Collecting herself, she stepped out of bed and made her way cautiously towards the door. With a trembling hand, she took hold of the handle. She eased the door open a fraction and peered through the gap into the darkness of the corridor beyond. There was nobody there. Ever since that night, the family had heard similar knocks and taps throughout the house. Audrey was certain that, on a separate occasion, she heard footsteps descending the stairs with a clearly defined shifting of weight from one foot to another. She was alone in the house at the time. A few weeks later, Audrey's mother Rose woke up after feeling a violent jolt against her bed. Not long after, despite being partially deaf, she was woken in the middle of the night by an inexplicably loud crashing sound coming from just outside the door. It was as if the door itself were being smashed in.
Hey girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Unlike Rose and Audrey, Derek Page hadn't heard these noises himself and joked that it was probably just old Tories who used to own the house, turning in their graves at the thought of him living there. He did recount one rather strange story of his own, however. Not long after they'd moved in, his mother travelled down from Manchester to stay with the family for a few weeks. After a couple of nights sleeping in the spare bedroom, she began to experience a recurring set of bizarre and terrifying nightmares. A couple of times, she found herself floating out of her body and looking down at herself as she slept. As she stared down, she had the very vivid sense that something profoundly malignant was trying to pull her away, and that if she didn't return to her body, she would never wake up. Other times, she dreamt that she was trapped under the legs of a horse as it kicked violently at her face. After less than a week, having also started to hear the noises, she made a hasty retreat back to Manchester. Audrey and Rose told the young journalist that the knocking sounds had grown worse over the last few weeks, and that increasingly, they seemed to be coming from one room. Located at the north end of the first floor, the family figured the room was once a bedroom owing to its size, but since it had never been rigged up to the mains, they were currently using it for storage and rarely went inside it. After leaving Hannath Hall that afternoon, journalist Anthony Wilmot decided to do some further digging of his own, and that, as he explained to Tony Cornell over the phone a few weeks later, was when things started to get really interesting. The house, as he discovered, was built sometime in the 16th century and was thought originally to have belonged to a Richard Sparrow, earning it the nickname Sparrow's Nest. Over the years, it passed through a number of owners, gaining its current name after being purchased by a Joseph Hannath in 1812. The house was sold again to George Williams in 1899, who elected to keep the name Hannath Hall. Wilmot got in touch with the building's current owner, Hugh Williams, George's grandson, to find out more. Much to his surprise, Hugh and his family, who'd lived in the house for 40 years before renting it out to Audrey and Derek, were more than familiar with the spooky goings-on there. Hugh went on to describe an incident a few years earlier involving his brother Peter. While staying alone in the house, he had apparently witnessed a door handle turning of its own accord. Another time, Hugh's nieces suffered vivid nightmares while sleeping in the now disused room at the far end of the property. They'd also apparently woken up one night to find a pair of blood-stained hands floating in the room with them. That wouldn't be the bedroom on the north side, would it, by any chance? Wilmot had asked. Oh, you mean the haunted bedroom, replied Hugh. As it turned out, Hugh Williams's family had taken to calling the north end bedroom the haunted bedroom on account of a morbid story they'd heard about one of the previous owners. Long before the house was wired for electricity, the so-called haunted room was in fact the master bedroom. As the story went, it was in this room that the wife of former owner, Joseph Hannath, who bought the property from his father in 1812, had died young. Her death left Joseph so bereft he couldn't bear to release the body for burial, so he decided instead to have it interred in an open coffin, which he kept at the end of his bed. For 6 weeks, an increasingly unhinged Joseph continued to order his servants to bring his wife 3 meals a day, while her body steadily putrefied. Eventually, with the stench becoming unbearable, Joseph was brought to his senses just long enough to take the body into the front garden, where he was said to have buried it under a large horse chestnut tree. As Wilmot explained to Tony over the phone, because his article about the house had been well received, and with Halloween drawing near, he asked Derek and Audrey if he could spend a night in the house and write about it. Since the couple were eager to prove they weren't making anything up, they invited Wilmot to stay. And so, on the 31st of October, Wilmot arrived again at Hanneth Hall, this time with a senior colleague from the paper and a friend who lived locally, along with his pet Labrador, Simba. Later that night, as the devil's hour approached, and with Audrey, Rose, and the children fast asleep, Derek Page, Wilmot, and his colleague took up positions on the landing, while Wilmot's friend and Simba kept watch in the old master bedroom. Despite some initial nervous joshing, it hadn't taken long for a pervasive eeriness to descend. Then, from somewhere in the house, a clock struck 12, and Simba began to whimper mournfully. A noise was heard, coming from inside a spare bedroom off to the side, but not one of the men had the courage to investigate it. A moment later, they all sensed a significant drop in temperature, followed by the smell of sandalwood that seemed to be sweeping back and forth along the corridor. Although little else occurred that evening, whether it had been the charge of the occasion or merely the atmosphere of the evocative old building, when the men finally called it a night at 2:30 a.m., it was with the distinct impression that they had experienced something. It was a few days later, unable to shake the weight of the evening from his mind, that Wilmot decided to get in touch with the Society of Psychical Research. It's just after 8 p.m. on the evening of 17th November 1957, with only the barest sliver of a waning moon in the sky. Tony Cornell and fellow CUSPR members Alan Gould, David Murray, and Michael Brotherton assemble briefly outside Tony's apartment before getting into his car and heading out towards Wisbeach. With Cambridge's university towers and spires receding behind them, they soon slip out beyond the city's edge and into the darkness of the East Anglian countryside. They made their way north along winding country roads. As their eyes adjusted to the dark, a wide menagerie of stars began to emerge above, while ahead, the rich black earth and shimmering waterways of the Fens were approaching. It has just gone 10 p.m. when the team eventually arrive at the pretty market town of Wisbeach, located on the banks of the River Nen. The town, known as the capital of the Fens, is a rare static fixture in an otherwise ever-changing landscape. 400 years ago, the region was a mass of treacherous peaty swamps and quicksilver surfaces, a perilous place for unsuspecting travellers foolish enough to go chasing the many will-o'-wisps that regularly danced across its transitory plains. They may appear tamed for now, but the Fens remain a border country where the firm and fluid mingle of histories washed from the land and an ever-shifting reminder of the illusion of solidity. Turning into the town centre, the team spot the short and bespectacled Anthony Wilmot. He's waiting for them outside the Rose and Crown pub, along with two friends he's unexpectedly brought along for the evening. The appearance of the two men, who introduce themselves as Mr. Trumpus and Mr. Perryman, immediately raises Alan Gould's suspicions, concerned that they might be under instruction from the journalist to guarantee some strange goings-on later. "We should keep an eye on them," he warns the others as they drive off again. The group continue in convoy behind Wilmot's car. It's not long before they're back among the fields and waterways, staring out at the edge of Fenland Flats, that seem to merge with the night when the temperature takes a sudden plunge The men watch with concern as a thick fog starts to sweep across the fields until finally it has all but engulfed the cars. Tony works hard at the wheel to keep Wilmot's rear lights in view as Alan struggles to locate their position on the map. After another 10 minutes or so, Tony catches Wilmot making a sharp left turn, which according to Alan has them heading in the direction of the small hamlet of Tide St. Mary. With Wilmot's car now having disappeared into the fog, they have little option but to continue straight along the road.
Hey girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
After half a mile or so, the fog finally begins to clear, revealing the journalist Wilmot's car parked up ahead at the entrance to a driveway, and in a space some 50 yards beyond, obscured by darkness and a dense row of tall trees, they can just make out the imposing presence of Hannath Hall. As Tony turns into the drive, moving through the line of trees, the large red brick pile looms out of the darkness. There is something of the dark fairy tale about the five-bedroom Elizabethan manor, flanked by two prominent gable roofs and shrouded by trees that seem unusually tall for these parts. Its stately symmetry, oddly offset by the peculiar placement of the building's central windows. That all the windows appear so small for such a large facade, and with only one presently lit from within, does little to dispel the ominous air of the building's brooding visage. Seeing the place now up close, how its lines have warped and buckled with age, and how thirstily the creeping vines of ivy seem to be claiming it for their own, it feels as much a natural part of the landscape as any surrounding birch or alder. As the men exit their car, making sure to remember their notebooks, they are struck by the stillness. A strained animal cry from the dark of the field opposite breaks the silence. "Impressive, isn't it?" says Wilmot as he walks round to the front. "Come on, I'll introduce you." With Derek and Audrey out at the cinema and the children tucked up in bed, Audrey's mother Rose steps out to welcome the men. She invited them to come inside and take a seat in the living room, a comparatively small space at the front of the house. Rose disappears to make teas and coffees as the men take seats around the table. With a warm fire licking and crackling at the back of the room, Wilmot takes the opportunity to recount the details of his last visit. It isn't long before talk turns to the haunted bedroom. "Yes, that's where I hear it coming from too," says Rose as she brings the drinks into the room, barely audible above the growing chatter of the men. "What was that?" asks Tony, as Rose quietly takes a seat beside him at the table. "The dreadful knockings," she replies, bringing a sudden hush to the room. "Have you heard them recently, Mrs. Halls?" asks Alan, as they all move in closer to listen. "Oh, yes, I heard them only 2 hours ago," she replies. At that moment, the sound of the opening front door is followed by the entrance of Derek and Audrey. They apologized for their lateness and quickly set about introducing themselves to Tony and the rest of the group. A short time after returning home, Audrey leads everyone on a tour of the house, first to the large washroom at the north end, then back to the living room. She points out the pantry and the kitchen as they go, before taking them through to an impressive dining room at the back of the southern end, and on into the equally impressive lounge at the front. They continue up the red-carpeted stairs and onto the landing. It was on these stairs, Audrey explains, that she'd heard the sound of footsteps not long after they moved in. The landing is illuminated with a single bulb, which flickers weakly as it struggles to keep the shadows at bay. Along the walls are a number of antique military artifacts that have belonged to the Williams family for generations. Continuing the tour, Audrey points out her mother's bedroom at the back, followed by the present-day master bedroom where she and Derek sleep, directly opposite. Moving quietly over the thickly carpeted hall, past the antique swords and flintlocks, Audrey stops the men outside the children's room and gives the door a gentle push. Inside are the two small bodies of her 3-year-old son and 5-year-old daughter, lying sound asleep in their beds. Moving on again, just past the children's room to the right, is the spare bedroom where Derek's mother experienced her unsettling dreams. And then finally, they come to the large, disused room at the northern end. "The haunted bedroom," says Wilmot from the back. "Let's call this bedroom A, shall we?" says Alan, eager to keep things professional. "May I?" asks Tony, looking to Audrey. "Please, but remember there's no light, so you'll need to switch on your torches." Tony eases the door open and, assisted by Alan and Michael's torchlight, leads the group inside. Moving the beams of light around, they spot a number of packing cases stacked up against the inside left corner, with further piles of books and chairs placed up on top of them. 3 chairs and a dressing table are lined up against the back, and in the far left corner, pieces of a dismantled brass bed lean against the wall. A few other bits and pieces are dotted about, including 2 mattresses on the floor, lying end to end under the front window. As Anthony Wilmot explains, they were placed there on his last visit to the house when he and his friends had kept their late-night vigil. Alan and Tony agree it will be useful to keep them as they are for sitting on later. Next, Derek leads the group outside to make a quick inspection of the exterior, but they find nothing of note. Once back inside, the group synchronize their watches. Then, while Alan makes his way upstairs to keep an eye out for any strange happenings above, Tony, David, and Michael gather everyone else into the living room to begin the next stage of their investigation. A good old-fashioned seance. You've been listening to Unexplained, Season 7, Episode 20, The Haunting of Hanneth Hall, Part 1. The second and final part will be released next Friday, May 3rd. This episode was written by Richard McLean Smith. Unexplained is an AV Club Productions podcast created by Richard McLean Smith. All other elements of the podcast, including the music, are also produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, with stories never before featured on the show, is now available to buy worldwide. You can purchase from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones and other bookstores. Please subscribe to and rate the show wherever you get your podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can find out more at unexplainedpodcast.com and reach us online through Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.
Hey girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.